You are listening to Fair Enough by Art Cologne and Texte zur Kunst. Your deep dive into the global art world. Thoughtful, intentional, and always ready to play.
Hello, and welcome to Fair Enough, a podcast series by Art Cologne in collaboration with Texte zur Kunst. Fair Enough brings together artists, curators, writers, and thinkers to reflect on how art and its institutions are responding to the urgencies of our present moment. This season, marking the 35th anniversary of Texte zur Kunst, we're taking up the journal's motto for the year, "There is no art without criticism." Each episode returns to a past issue of the journal to revisit the debates it sparked and to consider how those questions continue to shape the cultural and political landscape today. Today's conversation reflects on an article from the upcoming anniversary issue of Texte zur Kunst on system change, art market, and criticism, which will be released this December. My name is Michaela Dixon, and I'm your host, and today we are joined by Tom McDonough. Tom McDonough is a professor of art history at Binghamton University, State University of New York, where he teaches modern and contemporary art. The author and editor of several books on postwar art, he is a frequent contributor to journals such as Art Forum, October, and Texte zur Kunst, and has published extensively on a wide range of contemporary artists, including Leonora Antunes, Rio Garcia Torres, Adam Pendleton, Amy Siegel, Christopher Williams, and Hege Yang. Thank you so much for joining us today, Tom. I wanted to start this episode with a question about the article that you've written for the forthcoming issue of Texte zur Kunst titled Through Foul and Fairs. Can you give us a synopsis about the article?
Absolutely. And thanks for having me on, Michaela. It's really nice to be here with you. So the article, I guess I would say, is inspired by recent reading and conversations that I've had. Back in the spring, the Art Basel UBS Art Market Report for 25 came out, and I, along with many others, were parsing that for to read the tea leaves, so to speak. And then there were also a number of pieces that had come out recently, more recently, over the summer and even into the fall in the New York Times, when Tim Blum closed his gallery, mostly associated with LA, but outposts elsewhere. There was a big piece in the New Yorker on the state of Sotheby's. All of this had me thinking a bit about where we are in terms of the art market. And then, of course, conversations that you're having with friends, with artists, and with dealers. Maybe bringing together some of that concrete information along with a sense of the vibes at the current moment to think about, let's say, if we're going to be really blunt, to say something like the multiple challenges, if not crises, facing the art market and how people are responding. I mean, I think that's at the core of the piece, in a sense, in this current moment, how galleries especially are adapting to a really rapidly shifting environment, and whether we can step back and see some broader trends. And I tried to think about, let's say, a moment where a cutthroat competition is maybe shifting towards models of cooperation or these hybrids, in a sense, of competition and cooperation, given the marketplace, and what those might be telling us. Mm. That's in a very broad sense.
Yeah, yeah.
What the article is trying to do.
In a way, I liked this idea of like cooperation, co-opetition as a sort of, I guess, a kind of like it's a new form of thinking about competition. So sort of doing away with this idea of competition because it's not anymore serving the realities of the art market. Also, it's this idea that, if business is good for you, hopefully business is good for your friend, et cetera, and that like all together. In a more collaborative approach of thinking about the art market, there will be slices of the pie left for everybody.
Yeah, exactly. So this It's a kind of business jargon, a horrible neologism, to be honest, co-opetition, that two sort of prominent business consultant people developed in the 1990s, and they were really responding to this idea that traditionally in business consulting it was all about how to trample your competition. It was a winner take all model, and they were both really devotees of game theory. And the idea was that they developed through this close reading of game theory was that actually, yes, exactly as you were saying, effectively, there are a lot of business strategies that, while benefiting you, like to get the most benefit, you're also benefiting potential rivals. And so that we work best, business can work best in this model of a hybrid of competition and cooperation. Okay, that's pretty abstract. But we've seen a more explicit turn to something like this in the art world in the last few years. I'm thinking of spaces like the campus in upstate New York in the Hudson Valley up in Kinderhook, opened for the first time in summer 24. Group of six or so Tribeca, largely Tribeca-based galleries. That came together to buy a disused high school that they could use as a as an exhibition space during the summer, but also as year-round storage because just the price of real estate in New York has gotten to be the point where trying to find storage space anywhere close to Manhattan is almost impossible to afford. So the campus was something I was thinking about. I had written about it briefly when it opened in 24 for Texas Zukunft. And then we have lots of other things. I mean, there's models like Condo where galleries host other galleries. We find some booth sharing in the art fairs. There's like a whole range of new ideas, kind of improvised, let's say, that are happening, that I was wondering if we could productively put under that rubric of cooperative competition or co-opetition. Yes.
I liked this part of the article, or kind of it was sort of, I found it almost kind of funny, this thinking about business, in a more competitive mindset to be also this, the idea is that it's a kind of a form of warfare where, we're looking to like annihilate our competitor, really. And I even thought like this way of thinking between management consultants, as you mentioned in the article, is sort of a, it's a funny, it's kind of, it's a funny picture. It's a funny scene.
Yeah, well, it's like the law of the jungle. It's survival of the fittest. These kinds of models, and I think, yeah. Now, the question, in a sense, is: did the art world ever exactly function according to those models? Right. I mean, I want to be careful here because I'm trying to bring in an idea that will help us conceptualize something, even as I'm going to annoyingly, perhaps, speak with you about the limitations of that model, because the art world is a particular place, and even though it is a world of business without a doubt, it's a business of a very particular sort, and there, in a sense, there are other competing demands that limit competition in the art world. The art world has never been, I mean, of course, no capitalist marketplace has ever been a pure marketplace, but the art world, maybe even more so than others, has always resisted a kind of realm of pure competition, I would say.
It brings me to think about the argument also that you make around monopolies in particular. So something that we're seeing, which is that the players at the top 1%, 10% of the market really have the market share of the money at the moment for many reasons, but it also parallels how business was working in all these other industries too, where you see the presence of monopolies becoming clearer and clearer and clearer. And then so it becomes problematic for, the middle and the smaller tier galleries.
Yeah.
It makes sense to think about sharing a booth, et cetera, as a way to counteract sort
No,
of.
absolutely. And obviously, like, we're living broadly, we can say, economically in an age of consolidation and growing monopolization. There's for various reasons, governments seem unwilling or unable, as they had in the past, to block monopolies. And in the bigger world, that's in many ways tied both to big political shifts, but also new kind of the new models that technology has brought forward that make it harder, perhaps, to envisage what how to break up monopolies. And in the art world, yes, I think we've seen a handful of large, mega galleries, blue chip galleries, increasingly occupy larger and larger, both literal pieces of real estate, but also, more and more of the geography of the art world, and bringing in ever larger rosters of artists, which I think has really created serious challenges for mid-size, especially mid-size galleries. Now, I want to be careful, because I think there's a danger here of describing a situation in which the mega gallery has all the power, and there are these trends towards monopolization, and these are huge problems. But the Art Basel UBS report would give us pause in a sense, because it's precisely the top end of the market that suffered the most.
Interesting.
You know, it's precisely the sales of over $10 million that have dropped most precipitously, at least as far as we know.
Totally.
And so when you're running, these huge pieces of real estate in multiple global cities, that's a real problem. I mean, you think about what monthly you need to generate just to keep that machine rolling.
Your costs are.
So I don't have any, like, I want to be careful here. I don't want to
No,
see
no,
you be,
no. No, you're right.
pointing
It's
towards
good
the
to point it
Hausmann
out.
Wirths
No,
and
no,
the
no, no.
Boghossians and
No,
those
no.
Werners, and being like, oh, they have it all,
No, no,
because
no,
they,
no.
they are
Yeah.
running on the red treadmill in some ways faster than anyone else.
Yeah, the stakes are
And
very high for them.
yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a sense in which, and I'm not, I mean, I'm not like the idea isn't for me to come here and be like the prognosticator of doom or something
No,
like
no,
this,
no,
obviously.
no.
But there's a sense in which it's a system that's not really working terribly well for anybody at the moment. And this gets to the other side of things. I mean, there's the hardcore of the money, of course, right? And whatever we read in the paper and the reports, I mean, like, talking with people, it sounds even worse, right? I mean, talking with folks, there is a real sense that there's some big problems. And you can just think of all the closures, all the galleries that have, that have been shuttered in the last couple of years. But beyond that, I was having dinner with an artist friend, relatively senior figure, and he just said, nobody's having fun. And like, the reason we're in this at some level is because it was fun. And dealers, artists, collectors, that seems to be lacking in a sense. And I mean, that may not be the biggest problem in our world today. But it gets at the maybe the cultural aspect of the crisis we're talking about. It's not only an economic one,
No, I mean
but a
it's
broader question about purpose, maybe.
yeah. No, indeed, it's certainly just one of the things that's going on at in the world at this juncture, but it does affect people like you, people like me who are also working and trying to sustain the economy of this world and want it to continue, etc. It's interesting.
No, I will just say, like, yes, absolutely. And if we want to talk about, if you're bringing up monopolization, I think we have to not think simply about the gallery world. Monopolization extends well beyond it, and really to think about the art press and the role of monopolization there. I mean, we have one media corporation that owns the three largest art magazines in the U.S., and we could say, three of the most significant, historically most significant voices. When Penske Media owns Art Forum, owns Art in America, owns Art News, That's a concerning thing. And I don't mean it in terms of editorial control. I think that's a separate issue, and I'm not even going to get into it today, with you. That's another conversation. I mean simply in terms of the risk of these things disappearing completely, because ultimately, none of those properties, I mean, art form is maybe a prestige property for them. It's never going to be economically significant. The money for them comes in owning Women's Wear Daily, owning Rolling Stone, owning all the Hollywood Reporter and things like that, because like Hollywood studios, when it comes Oscar time, they're going to be running full page ads for your consideration, blah, blah, blah. Like there's tons of money that comes in through those magazines. Art in America, like there just isn't, to be honest. And they have a, they have a kind of, they lend it a sort of legitimacy and prestige, perhaps, but if it ceases to be that, I think we really run a risk of losing, losing those titles. And that kind of consolidation worries me as much in a sense as mega galleries hoovering up promising young artists out of other gallery stables.
No, it's a good point to sort of extend it also beyond the gallery world, so we can also see that this problem, there can be a lot of thinking about solidarity in these ways too, that it's an issue that will afflict really A to Z of the of everybody who's in this world. It kind of, it means maybe that there's a possibility to for meaningful change too, because all of us will face a reality of monopolization in different ways, but still we will face it. I was wondering, in particular, because you're an art historian, it's interesting to think about like current economic pressures, et cetera, and see where you situate that somehow in like a longer, like in a longer view, in a longer lens. Do you see or forms of artistic production mirroring what's happening in the market? So let's say,
Oh, yeah. Okay. Sure.
or
Well, I think there are a couple, like, let's say maybe I would want to think about two possibilities there in a sense. And certainly let's take the bad side first, right? And I think we can say that for some time now, for well over a decade, we've seen forms of art that seem that really are if not produced by the market itself, are really
geared towards it.
creatures of a certain like the production of a certain desire, for collectors. And I mean, we have like Walter Robinson coined zombie formalism back in the 2010s, which had its heyday. We saw, I mean, because of the low interest rates during COVID, those historically like historically cheap money, there was just so much money sloshing around, and it had to go somewhere. And so we had like NFTs as a brief, mercifully, I'm touching wood as I say it, Michaela, a mercifully brief speculative frenzy in the art world. Our friend Beeple, and most emblematically, but not alone. Even in a sense, the vogue for certain forms of figurative painting, which again is a more complicated landscape, I want to say. I mean, I think we'd have to make some finer distinctions, but certainly there's been a range of figurative painting that has found an easy, fast consumption in the market, and like among a number of younger artists whose careers have risen rapidly and crashed often just as rapidly. So I think we absolutely can see work that responds like that. That's a product of this moment in a sense, sure. But I think there's something else as well, and I do think there are the potentials of artists building their own networks in a way, right? Like everything isn't the market, and those forms of friendship and solidarity do exist, you know? And I'm going to take only one really big example, and you may look at me and say, well, come on, you know, these are all like super famous people, so give me a break. But I really think, like, if you look at an artist like Jan Vogt, who has built a, like, along with building his career, has built a kind of network of people around him of multiple generations, some older kind of mentor type figures, some his own age, that, you know, which he'll often exhibit along with his own work, and not because not out of a market
No.
situation. You know, Ronnie Horne doesn't need to, you know, show work with Jan Vogt, right? But it's a way of signaling, I think, a set of affinities and solidarities that I find really inspiring, moving often. And I think that exists at multiple levels. I mean, obviously, you know, these are figures that are well known and the like. But I think that kind of organizing, that kind of sense of preserving relationships at a distance from the market, is really powerful.
It reminds me a lot of some kind of an approach to community making. Always, as you said, maybe we're not having fun anymore, but hopefully there's some aspect of like community and solidarity somewhere in that process. Because on some level too, I mean, exhibitions can be a very lonely sport somehow. I mean, like the solo exhibition in particular, as a model, you know, it's like a one artist being display, being platform, and it's interesting to think about everything that happens around that, of course, but also how you can leverage your own platform for others, whether that becomes, you know, something that's financially successful or not, or even, you know, in some exhibition makings, there'll be like inspiration, even if it's historical inspiration, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think this is where independent spaces continue to play a really crucial role. I've remained really struck by the degree to which in my part of the world, artist space continues to be a place for like multiple generations of artists to meet and be together. An opening at artist space is a really distinct cross section of New York. And even just, you know, the fact that Jay Sanders, you know, Stella, the curator, are often in the space and there to talk to young, you know, young painters who are or artists who are walking down from Cooper Union or NYU or whatever, right? They're there to have those conversations day in and day out. I think that's a community building that is desperately needed. And artist spaces served that role for a long time. I mean, that was true under Stefan Kallmeyer, you know, a number of years ago. You know, in a New York that can feel often very alienating and sort of too big and too exclusive to break into. I think artist space has really offered a model for how to preserve a community in a world that can feel very anomic.
Yeah,
Yes.
definitely. The other point, sort of, I was thinking about too, talking about like the sort of alienated, individual-esque, let's say, I think this word individual, of course, nowadays is quite negative, which maybe is for good reason, but it brings me a bit to the argument that you bring up around post-Fordism in particular. I think for most people who've been maybe in any kind of like art theory zone in the last 10 years, it's a term you maybe will be a bit familiar with. But for those who are not familiar with the kind of the essence of post-Fordism, would you explain a bit what that shift represents and what you
Sure,
expect
sure.
it to lead
I'll put on my David Harvey
to?
hat for a
Please.
moment here, the great sociologist of post-Fordism. Let's say post-Fordism broadly names a shift in how our economies work, a move from 20th century economies of scale. You know, think about 20th century American car manufacturers that owned the rubber plantations in Brazil and, you know, commanded every aspect of the line, these kind of standardized products produced on assembly lines, produced at a mass scale. Post-Fordism names a shift towards more flexible modes of production, first pioneered in Japan in the 1970s and then really spread globally, the notion of just-in-time production, the increasing automation, but also the maybe more relevant for our end of the world, the along with these changes came a change in the nature of work, right? Labor ceased to be the labor on the assembly line that was so de-skilled in the sense of like my job for, 8 hours, 10 hours a day was putting one screw in one part of the car as it came down the assembly line. And I just was there to repeat that task over and over. Under post-Fordism, the worker has a much, has like there's a greater degree of intellectual labor that necessarily goes in. There's a set of decisions that worker that are devolved onto the worker. So along with flexibilization comes a kind of mobilization of of that intellectual role. The art market, let's say it's complicated, I would say. The art market obviously is part of this, without a doubt. I guess I would want to say the art market is a curious place. And on the one hand, we can say that it is almost a model or emblematic form of the post-Fordist workplace, right? To the degree to which the art market relies upon, like labor in the art market is intellectual labor. It is a, like we call it discursive labor. It's always where we're, it's not simply about the oil paint on canvas or the fabricated object, but it's about the language we build around it to convince people of its significance and importance. We live very much in that realm of intellectual labor that's at the core of post-Fordism. At the same time, it seems to me, and I mean, you can see, I ask whether you would agree, I don't know, but the art market also is a like a hybrid of that most like contemporary form of labor, along with these strange archaic survivals. I mean, the art market could almost be an 18th century thing, to the degree to which it relies on, the art market relies on, the charisma of individual figures. It relies on secrecy, and the like, so that, it's this weird kind of combination or monster in a
Totally.
way
I mean,
of
it's such
the
a
very contemporary and the ancient.
such a contact space of really, of being of being kind of like, with one another, around one another, interacting, having relationships. It's so fundamental. But, you think about it even, behind the secrecy of like how people get solo exhibitions, et cetera, whatever. However, it's really a relationship world. It reminds me a lot, actually, this conversation too also reminds me of this sort of notion that came up maybe 10 years ago, maybe more, which was a question around sites like Artsy, et cetera. There was this idea of who would be the kind of next disruptor in our world, who could change it, who would change the fabric of the online art space in particular. I mean, I'm not personally an online art expert, so I can't speak to it, but it almost seems to me like that hasn't really had its heyday. That actually hasn't, come up in some completely disruptive fashion.
No, I think this is, yeah, this is a curious thing, but I might, and again, I want to be careful. I'm coming to and speaking with you today as an observer of this world, but I am not an economist of the art world. I'm not a market expert. So one has to take what I'm saying with a particular grain of salt, perhaps. But it seems, yes, the art market has not experienced the kind of disruption that other industries have. It still remains a very personality-driven and very personalized world in many ways. And the attempts to move things into a more let's say, a more digital realm, often under the rubric of a new transparency, have really never gone very far. I mean, that's a my impression, at least, is that's a tiny fraction of sales. And often those disruptive models have ended up being re-territorialized within the gallery system in any event,
Totally, yeah.
Like, you can go on David Zwirner and have a digital platform for buying prints. You don't need to even go to Artsy. So
Yeah.
sure. But to come back, maybe to pull that abstruse set of comments about post-Fordism back to where we began, it would just be to say this hybrid model of cooperation competition that we began with is in many ways a characteristic of a post-Fordist marketplace, and in fact these ideas, even before they were discussed in kind of business managerial circles and consultancy circles, were already being played around with, tossed around with by actually usually left-wing economists who were trying to theorize the shifts that they saw, the macro level shifts that they saw happening in the UK and in America, the neoliberal changes in the late 70s, early 80s under, we usually say under Reagan and Thatcher, right? Even though in America, really, it started under Carter, but whatever, we won't say that. They were trying to think about those kinds of shifts and what was happening in the workplace, and they were already thinking about these new forms of co-opetition. They didn't use exactly that term, but essentially are speaking about the same thing. Sure.
When you look at earlier downturns, like in the early 90s or post 2008, for example, what do you think feels particularly unique about the present circumstances of the market?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I've really been thinking about that because my own entry into the art world was later 80s, New York, and really, catching the very end of the 80s boom and then that collapse with the larger, like with the larger crisis in the stock market. And what was interesting about that moment, it seems to me, is that it actually was an incredibly productive moment, because what the collapse in the art market allowed was suddenly a whole new crop of smaller galleries to open, and a new, like not only smaller galleries, new galleries opening, but also them bringing in new young artists. And the kind of work we hadn't really seen before. So I actually remember it as a very dynamic moment, like lots of interesting new spaces opening, both commercially, but then like strange experimental spaces, like you may not remember or know, like thread waxing space on Lower Broadway, which was, actually like a big loft and showing like early Nary Ward, and like it's a like really interesting space. New little magazines cropping up. Josh Dechter starts publishing Acme magazine, which is doing all these great interviews and conversations and pieces. So like it was a, to my mind, from a someone in their 20s, right? It was like a really dynamic moment and actually really productive, sort of cleared a ground and set up a whole new range of possibilities. But that was because real estate was affordable. I mean, like, not to be like super blunt, but it was because it was affordable to do so. The art market crash also coincide. I mean, like, this is, I'm going to make every younger person listening to this podcast angry when I say, when I moved to New York, the landlord lowered my rent
Oh my
from
God.
what the previous person had been paying.
Yeah.
Like that was what could happen, right? Sorry.
Unthinkable now. It's unthinkable. It's
So there was the possibility for these new, like for this whole burgeoning crop of younger galleries to open up. And my concern in a way is that we're in a not dissimilar moment in terms of spaces closing and there being this real sense of a moment passing. But real estate, at least in the metropolitan centers, remaining so expensive that the prospect of opening a space is just hugely challenging. That said, people do it. I mean, I can't come here and be a prophet of doom, because you see young people continually with the energy against the odds of just doing it. You look at a space like Ulrich in New York, right? With the most modest means. and presenting some great exhibitions over these like last, you know, whatever. Now it's probably not that, I mean, it's not that recent. It's probably 6 years or something like that. But they've been, you know, like so I think there is always some energy. There is always something resisting. But at least at scale, I think it's very hard to do right now in New York. It's just terribly difficult to afford to take that risk, right? Because ultimately, this is about like the willingness to assume a huge amount of risk.
Tremendous amount of risk. And I always say to people, I think if you're not majorly risk, like I think to be a gallerist somehow is to be somebody who is can handle a lot of risk, you know, can really can surf that wave of insecurity, like financial insecurity. I mean, depending on, of course, how you finance your gallery, et cetera, but still it's not necessary. It's I say it often to people, you know, it's not that you're a grocery store. Like it's your business model is really particular, and so you which is an amazing thing, but you also have to think also sometimes quite creatively about what that means for the artists that you work with and also your own livelihood, et cetera. One term that somehow I feel like keeps coming up in a lot of conversations about also the current state of affairs, which is quite a generic term, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts about it. Or is this idea that the moment is sort of defined by like late capitalist logic. So it's like late stage capitalism. It's this kind of that this is a bit the product of that has been sort of maybe even, I don't know, kind of coming down the pipeline for some time. How do you respond to this argument or this idea?
Yeah, I think it's like a really, it's a very big picture kind of question, I would say, which is important to think about. And I think there's no single, I mean, I'm going to say maybe there's no single answer. Obviously, maybe we could say late capitalism, and the term itself is a bit problematic because it always like gives us hope that like it's going to change. Like, well, you know, what comes after late, the new thing. Let's say
Extra
like
late.
advanced capitalism or our current, you know, neoliberal, militarized neoliberalism, whatever one wants to call it. Let's say that it, or spectacle, you know, a spectacle commodity world, you know, does a very good job at destroying the very foundations of the thing it's trying to profit from. And that's true at a big scale, like climate. And it's true in the art world, you know, as well. It's true at our scale, that you know, the very kind of fermenting creativity that it wants to make money from, it is also crushing, you know, at the same time. And I think at some broad level, I would want to say that's true. But I would also have to acknowledge that the art market, and maybe this comes with that weird hybrid monstrous nature that I was talking about earlier. You know, the art market has what we could call a kind of relative autonomy from other industries. You know, I think for a long time, critics like critical theorists have been, you know, prognosticating or predicting the kind of collapse of the contemporary art world into sort of the world of luxury brands and fashion. You know, that's been something for 2 decades, probably. People have been lamenting, you know, but we're always only ever on the verge of it, right? It never really quite happens, you know. And it's not to say that they're not intertwined, and it's not to say, of course, but it never really becomes the same thing. I mean, there's, and I don't want to sound, I don't want to generalize, and I don't want to sound like a Pollyanna, but like also like art is too weird at some level. I mean, and artists are too weird for that to ever exactly happened, it seems to me. The question is whether and how that relative autonomy can be preserved, you know? And I think so in other words, not to simply assume that as a permanent state or as inevitable, but to acknowledge that it's something we always have to struggle to maintain. And that's something we have to do as critics. It's something our colleagues at in the galleries need to think about. It's something that collectors need to think about. It's something that we all kind of have our way of contributing towards, I think, you know? I mean, art, and like maybe it's to say also, like, art is never just its market.
Yeah, it's a question of like what the structures are in place somehow to be able to continue the possible making of art and that institution continues.
I mean, you know, like, we want to acknowledge that we live in a world where, you know, the power of capital, the power of cap, like the exchange relation that capital puts in place, is soaking ever deeper into us, you know? I mean, you know, into our very psyches and our senses of self, you know, that's the nature of the world we live in, absolutely. But there always has to be something outside of it. It can never completely colonize, you know, the human. And I think it's a matter of, at every level, trying to preserve what's human within us. And I think art, as I don't know, I you know, to my mind, art is an exemplary space for doing that at some level, you know, not always and not in every instance, but more so than almost anywhere else.
It's a fundamental human project, whatever that kind of means. But like from a cultural perspective, I think of like the cave drawings, for example.
Well, sure. We want to go back to, you know, back to Lascaux and, you know, Chaudefond. Yeah, we certainly could. I mean, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, art, like, okay, I mean, this is very dangerous and to you know to broach, but I really, yes, I do feel like there is a profound, like, spread throughout the species, you know, demand to make. It's one of the ways that we, yes, can assert both our autonomy and how we belong in the world. And art, even today, even in dire circumstances, continues to offer that possibility. And as I said, it's just we have to preserve the room for it.
A question that's come up a few times in some of the other episodes with some other guests has been the question of what the situation this it's also it's a big picture question, so that's my heads up. It's a sort of it's a question of like modernity in particular, sort of how we interface now with kind of what's left of the project of like modernity in particular. I've been sort of thinking in some of these episodes about in particular, the move from like the 19th century way of thinking in general about art and how that really changes in a dramatic way in the 20th century. And now, in the sort of postmodern era, these sort of questions seem somehow really more relevant than ever to me because, yeah, maybe even if we're waiting for something new to happen, it always, as you say, it does feel like we're on the verge of something else. We just don't know what that else is. And maybe we're waiting for Godot. Like maybe that doesn't come. I can't diagnose it myself, but I'm curious about how you see that, or how you see kind of like the remnants or the
Well,
concept.
there are two, let's say there are two broad models that we might want to put on the table and decide where we stand in relation to them, right? And on the one hand, you have folks who are going to say, we need more modernity. Like, we've never completed the promise of modernity. If we trace modernity back to the 18th century Enlightenment and this idea that, you know, human rationality can push out all the oppressions and irrationalisms that have been embedded in human society, you know, throughout its history. That, you know, this is the kind of there was a fame there is a famous German philosopher, right, Jürgen Habermas, who has, you know, rang this bell for decades, right? That modernity is an incomplete project, and we need to, you know, precisely not move, you know, not escape it, not move beyond it, but to push further into it, and to really live the promise, to realize the promise of those 18th century revolutions, the American Revolution, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, read that in a radical way, as someone like Hannah Arendt did, you know, the promise of the French Revolution, the rights of man, you know, those kinds of ideas. And I think there's powerful reasons to to acknowledge that and to argue that what we need is the further expansion of a kind of democratizing, rationalizing franchise, embracing ever more of humanity, right? So, the 18th century revolutions freed, like we're about universal white male suffrage. We need to continually expand that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? Okay, sure. I think there's another viewpoint, and it's one that I've been thinking a lot about lately, which is to say, actually, modernity has been an unmitigated nightmare from its very beginnings. And, as Marx writes, capitalist modernity is birthed in blood and gore. It's precisely premised on the doing away of the human commons, and the privatization of ever greater aspects of human existence, down now to the very level of our genome, right? Which can be copyrighted. And that our aim is not to extend the force of modernity, but rather to ask, like, how do we get out of the 20th century? I mean, we may be living in 2025, but we're still living in a 20th century world. How do we get out of modernity? And this is, what maybe a group like the kind of leftist academics and retort, someone like Tim Clark, has been thinking about for 20 years now, really, since the early 21st century. This what retort calls the world of militarized neoliberalism under conditions of spectacle. How do we get out of that? And I think in the art world, these projects to move us beyond modernity have had a lot of power in recent years. I mean, you think about Adriano Pedroza's Venice Biennale. I mean, I think that is one way to read a project like that. So, I mean, that's a very big picture answer to a sort of big picture question. If you're asking me where I stand on all of it, like you, I think it's a challenging question. I mean, I do feel the salutary, obdurate. Is it pessimism of the second position? Feels. I mean, it's a difficult. We're living in a difficult moment. Let's just say, we're living in a moment when it's very hard for me to acknowledge and celebrate the upsides of modernity, because its impacts, from climate to mass, to genocide, seem really clear right now. So I'm on the dark side, let's say, for the moment.
What do you think the way out of it is? That's a very speculative question.
Well, I think that preserving and rebuilding the commons wherever we can is maybe another way of thinking about it. And so that is a pro and then building solidarities across it. And so that has a place in like our end of the world. How do you preserve a space for art that isn't simply going to find its home in the market? How do you preserve forms of human solidarity, community, fun? I mean, because that's really what we're talking about, like fun. I mean, fun is a light way of a sort of like jokey way of saying something about happiness, like more serious, and mutual support. But that's also something that we can share with other people around the globe, because these are struggles that are happening, across the world, and in various forms. But that might be one way of thinking about what we do. Sure.
One question that we've been asking also to some guests after this sort of question around the 19th, 20th, 21st century is the kind of it's a speculative question about the current era of art history that we find ourselves in, which is not an easy question, but it's interesting to understand how people see the current moment, like art historically in particular, especially as people who study kind of like long durées of different periods. Some people, for example, have described it as this style, like the cultural style of immediacy. Anna Kornblau is a good example of that one, for example. So like the dust never settles, et cetera. It's a bit, there's no mediation. We're kind of going from one thing to the next. So almost this art history itself is kind of called into question existentially somehow. Another guest that we had on also called it, or she found it to maybe, it would, for her, it would be called something like no posterity. So, I mean, kind of slightly pessimistic maybe, but an interesting way of thinking about periodization in particular.
Yes, certainly. Again, if we want to like take a step back and place it in a larger context, we can say like we're living in a society that has been destroying any sense of history for a long for some time. I mean, if we want to think about modernity again, maybe relate that our art history is a victim in many ways, or our ability to periodize and conceptualize perhaps is a victim to that same sort of amnesiac culture that we live in. Certainly, as a practicing art historian, I can write you a prescription for this later. But as a practicing art historian, we see students wanting to address ever more recent work. That's been a problem, or problem. It's been a characteristic for some time. But I mean, when I came into the field, you were basically told, you can't really write anything within the last 40 years. Now it feels like you can't write on anything made in the last 40 hours at times, but I think, the challenge of periodization is not simply, it's also tied to our own uncertainty within the discipline of art history about where we are. So it's not simply like, oh, it's hard to characterize or diagnose the culture out there because we're not even sure what our culture is. I mean, I grew up in a discipline of art history that was very clear on what the project was, right? I mean, art history had been an intellectual backwater largely for generations. And then there was this incredible wave of innovation that swept through the field beginning in the late 1960s, early 1970s, right? A kind of critical wave rolling out of the activist movements of those years that gave us a feminist art history, gave us the new social history of art, these kinds of things, which crested then in the 80s and 90s as all of these insurgent historians took up positions in the major Ivy League, top programs, as critical theory was became a broadly accepted language and the like. That whole wave is ebbing now, right? I mean, it's ebbing humanly in that those people are retiring, but it's also ebbing in that the conviction, I mean, those models changed the field forever. Like, let's just say, of course, right? But the sense of what comes after or what the next project might be, I think, has remained deeply uncertain. And we can say, we've expand. I mean, if we're going to point to one project, it's been the expanding geographies of art history, the acknowledgement that we can no longer simply write a history of modern and contemporary art that's based in North America and Western Europe, but we look to Latin America, we look to Africa and the African diasporas, we look to East Asia, South Asia. We have a globalized art history, without a doubt, and that's been a very productive shift. But that hasn't challenged our definition of art. It hasn't challenged our definition of art history. In fact, it's often remained relatively conservative. It's been a project of expanding. It's essentially expanding what one might see on the walls of a museum, on the walls of a gallery, on the walls of a Biennale. Other kinds, like other names, different painters, different sculptors, but not really changing what we might think of as art. And I do think part of like what's incumbent on us as a younger generation, middle-aged generation of art historians is to really think about how we can take art out of its isolation. I mean, I think in a way, art history has spent too much time providing more fodder for the market, more objects that might be ultimately commoditized, even if that's not the aim of the art historians themselves, but it's new things that can arrive on those walls to be sold. I think we really need to think about how to move art out of the isolated realm it finds itself in the marketplace, in a set of kind of elite institutions. We need to really think about what the politics of the discipline are, you know, in that sense. And I think a kind of project of like a radical democratization, you know, might be something. Now that's not exactly, I mean, I know your question is more like, where are we in contemporary art? And I'm answering something maybe a little more esoteric, but one that I think is really like, if we think about the task of the future, the task of the future has to be more than our ability to better effectively name the present. I mean, that is a concern, and we spend a lot of time, art historians and critics, asking ourselves, what is the contemporary, you know, about a decade ago? But I think there's a bigger question,
No,
you know?
it's an interesting way to think about it too. I mean, it's also nice to have a kind of resistance to a particular aspect of the question too, that maybe something the question also has to be reformulated, because I think this idea maybe, or what I understand from your what you say too, is something that's more kind of like art for every, not for everyone, but maybe for a wider public. And so like an arts education system that also appeals to a wider public, and that culture is sort of less, finds itself less in particular, you know, it doesn't find itself anymore in this ivory tower, but really is like a project for in a commons for the masses, for
Interesting.
like in a completely different register.
Yeah, I think there are real possibilities there. And I think again, there's elements in contemporary art that point us towards those directions, and there are elements that are far outside of it. But I think we need to, in a way, and I'm not exclude I may want to be careful, Michaela. I'm not excluding myself from this. Like I'm not pretending that I've, you know, responded to this. This is a challenge for me as well, but it's something I increasingly think about, even as, you know, one's very com I mean, well, whatever, you know, we spend our lives working to be where we are, right? I mean, to learn specialized vocabularies, to build networks of colleagues, to teach our students to go see exhibitions. I mean, like, you know, that's a full-time job and a hard one. And we're and you know, we rightly enjoy that, in a sense, the privilege of where we are, you know? But I think recognizing how we can at times build walls around our, like even inadvertently even build walls around what it is that we're doing. And maybe make it so that we can't really see a fuller range of art shaping, creativity making, that surround us, you know?
Yeah, it's a question really somehow I find so much of like expertise in particular, like this question that art, it has a language that it can read as kind of in quotes pretentious. This is like a conversation that many people have, but I always think about like, you know, a language of experts is also something, it's a way also to build a knowledge base. It's a production of knowledge, and that's like that's also fundamentally important, but that doesn't have to be. You're always kind of like, if you're a person, I think, who really cares about this, you care about knowledge, you care about, you know, the dissemination of knowledge. You also understand there's parts of those things that have a certain kind of community in particular, but that doesn't make them elitist.
Yes, absolutely. And we do need, as in any field, we need specialized language in order to discuss things. But I think we need to be able to recognize, we need to be able to toggle between different kinds of languages, I would have to say. And we also need to be able to translate. I mean, maybe like our role as critics, as art historians, at least. And I think this is probably true for, I mean, in a way, gallerists are already, they've been doing this forever, right? How do we translate, you know? How do we, you know, translate between discourses? So we can have a certain kind of conversation, you and I, or around the seminar table. But how do we actually, like the knowledge that's generated there, how do we translate it into a language that is broadly able to be taken up broadly?
They can
And
be.
that's also maybe part of, maybe to come back to the initial prompt for this conversation, like this end of the con, you know, like this part of the conversation, you know, where are we in the contemporary? I mean, part of that is maybe our difficulty or our inability to adequately translate. Like we haven't been able to name something,
Right.
not because it potentially doesn't exist, but because we're wrapped into a kind of language that doesn't perm hasn't permitted a translation that would allow for a broader debate. I don't know. I
Yeah.
don't
No, I think
know.
it's quite interesting, I think, what you propose there, that it's also an issue that's situated in the language itself. I think this question of language in general, I mean, it's interesting to be working in visual art because it's almost this nice opportunity to be away from an aspect of language, even though you maybe deal with visual language, but it's different. But it often makes me think, for example, of I've brought it up a few times, but it's something that I think about often, like the deconstructionist thinkers and thinking about this way of language and this project, thinking about how what the legacies of that way of thinking are nowadays, even though that's
I mean, I'm gonna completely second what you're saying. And I'm going to say, yesterday I went with a group of my grad students down to Dia Beacon. And many of them are international students, never been to Dia before, had a vague idea of what it was. But, here we are, you're standing in these galleries and you're looking at, a room of Robert Ryman, you're looking at a room of Ankawara, you're looking at a, Donald Judd, you're looking at Meg Webster, Senga Nangudi. And I think one of the things that we ended up talking about that I thought was so interesting was the way that critical language, art historical language, often builds a kind of cage around the object. It's a way of domesticating it. And often it's a way of, it's almost like, and I don't know whether you have this impression, Michaela, but sometimes it really feels like you read something and you're like, well, that's a brilliant piece of writing, but does it really have anything to do with this, like this piece of art? Or it makes the art too comprehensible. You know what I mean? Like we want to explain it and like all away. And so we fit it into a box. And to fit it into that box, you have to ignore so much stuff. I mean, you must have had this experience. I mean, I'm sure you took art history classes and your professor tells you X, Y, and Z about a given painting. And then you actually go to the museum and you're like, what? Like this painting looks so different from what that guy was describing, Like, I mean, this is so much weirder. Like take any cubist painting, And then you think about the dumb language we generally use to describe it to our like students. Like, it's just so much more complicated. Or a Manet, or a Pollock, or Robert Morris, whatever you want. I'm sorry, I'm naming like horrible male artists, but like Eva Hesse, I mean Anna Mendieta, take your pick. And so I think, in a way the when someone like Derrida, if you really read him and when he's really going, what's amazing is that it is not a domestication of the text. It's not a domestication of the subject. It is precisely a continual opening, like ever more possibility opening up. And in a sense, he's never trying to explain something or analyze something. He's really creating, in a way, another artistic object alongside the one he's studying.
Totally.
And I think, what would an art history that looks like that? Now, I'm not saying to write like Derrida because that'd be a bloody disaster, we know, but like if we took that spirit,
That curiosity, that kind of like really that, yeah, that openness.
that ramifying, I think that, I mean that's a big ask because that really means that we have to think about writing in a very, not merely as an analytic kind of descriptive tool, but as a creative tool. But the best art history does it, right? I mean, Tim, I mean, when you read Tim Clark, discuss a Bruegel painting, and then you go back and it's not like, oh, he fit that painting in a box. It's like, oh my gosh, yes, like further in, deeper, deeper, deeper. Or like, that the Site of Death, the Poussin book that he wrote, spending a year or whatever in front of these two Poussin paintings at the Getty, I think that's a real, I think there's something to be said for it. And it
Totally.
pushes against our desire to consume things quickly and to look quickly.
Funny that you mentioned that book. I'm actually in the process of reading it right now,
Oh,
and
that's
it's
nice.
been a really interesting. It was a close friend of mine that bought me that book for my birthday, and it's who is a art historian also herself. So you can kind of
Okay.
understand where it comes
Sure.
from. But reading that book has been so interesting because it's like a diary entries of like every single day visiting these two paintings and looking at them in so many different kinds of light, in particular, thinking
Exactly.
about what light works well, what doesn't work well, what shows up, what doesn't show up. And also it's this, very, one of the paintings is this dark, this scene where this man has been killed by a snake.
Bitten by a snake, indeed.
And it's
Yes.
very, but it's an interesting experiment. I mean, he calls it really, an experiment in art writing, and it's kind of a conversation that's kind of come up a lot in these episodes. It's a question of art writing in particular. Maybe it makes sense that people that have like art history, literature, and critical theory backgrounds think a lot about how you do write about art, how you convey like meaning in that form. And it's not a clear project, and that's also something that's very interested in. It's very interesting to have conversations around it because it's not so clear what that project
Exactly.
is or what it can be. Although some people, I'm sure, have fantastic formulas for how to write fantastic press releases, and this is how
Without a doubt, without a doubt.
this is how it is.
Well, AI will take it over soon enough. Don't worry.
AI will take that over. But it's funny because when you try sometimes with AI, you realize it's really bad. I don't know if you've tried, but it can be horrific, and
Yes.
it's a borderline cringe. My final question for you. You mentioned your students, and I thought I wanted to ask, what are like some of the graduate students interested in writing about when it comes to art history? What are the dominant trends or themes of things that they're in particular attracted to at this moment?
That's a really good question. And I would say the projects that I've been most inspired by my students are the projects that remain the least recognizable, you know? So I'm gonna just mention one person who I feel like I've learned a huge amount from, in a way, right? So this is Josh Franco, who grew up in rural West Texas, Mexican American family, and grew up very near Marfa. You know, had an uncle who lived right on the roundabout heading out to Chinati, so he'd spend a lot of time with the uncle. And like they knew there was some white guy who owned all that property up there. Some art thing never went in really. The uncle at a certain point has a miraculous vision of the Virgin of Guadalupe in his front yard and builds a shrine, and that shrine becomes a pilgrimage site for Mexicans and Mexican Americans, like in a relatively wide area. And Josh, as an adult, he leaves West Texas. He, studies decolonial theory, studies art history, is working at Binghamton, learns who Donald Judd is, essentially as an art historian, and becomes really interested in Judd. Works as a tour guide at the Spring Street Building, things like that. But builds this dissertation around these two parallel but not really touching pilgrimage sites. Chinati, which is drawing this pilgrimage from art lovers around the world, and his uncle's house, which is drawing hundreds and hundreds of Mexican and Mexican American pilgrims. And now what I loved about the project is that if it had been written by someone in my generation, I had been writing it, it would have been like, the counter-hegemonic pilgrimage of these oppressed, migrants coming and against this kind of white heterosexual imposition on the landscape. Josh comes from a very different generation, and it's not a hierarchy. And he very beautifully weaves this interrelated topography of spaces together. And he's able to pay attention to the homemade shrine, which is a bathtub stood on its end with a painted plaster commercial piece of Virgin Mary statuary in it, able to pay attention to that as an example of a Hispanic aesthetic of rascuachismo, as he is to a Donald Judd box sitting in the hangar in Chinati. And he has this beautiful passage of sitting there through a day and of how the changing effects of light and heat shift, and how you can hear them pop as the afternoon heat builds. I mean, it's just this beautiful book. You're going to be able to read it because it's coming out with Duke University Press in this coming year. But like, this is the kind of work that is pushing. Like, it's not recognizable within our normal categories. He's not doing. He's you know, it's not a book on, Hispanic American art. It's, not a book on minimalism. It is a book on both, reading both against the grain. It doesn't have the kind of hierarchies that one might expect in any form. And it's beautifully written. And that is the kind, I mean, I'm not going to say that's typical of graduate student work necessarily, but this is what you wait, this is what you live for, to come away changed yourself, by the work. So there's fantastic work being done.
That's fantastic. That's great to hear about also the projects of young up and coming art historians. It's important.
I'll send you a copy when it comes
Please
out.
do. Please do. Thank you so much, Tom, for this really insightful conversation. I really, really enjoyed it.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Fair Enough by Art Cologne and Texte zur Kunst, where ideas travel and perspectives expand. From the world's first art fair to today's conversations on modern and contemporary art. The dialogue continues every fall live in Cologne. For more information, visit artcologne.com.